The following commentary is for educational purposes only. Always consult the appropriate tax, legal, or financial professionals before acting on any information heard in this program.
Welcome to the IRA Brothers. I'm Nick Edwards.
And I'm Nathan Edwards.
And Nate, I'm going to ask you a question, and Nathan doesn't know the question that I'm going to ask him. We're going to try yet another new form. You see, we're still in the feeling out phase of this show here, so we're going to try something new again.
Okay.
We tried something new last week, and we'll see if this one sticks a little bit better. This is something that's been on both of our minds. Okay, so here's your hints.
Okay.
You have to try to guess what the question is. That's been on both of our minds. It's been very important in the industry lately.
Okay.
And it's probably been on the minds of a lot of people who might hire a financial planner.
Okay.
As our industry has progressed and as technology has progressed, we're beginning to feel a little bit of pressure as professionals from what's known as the robo-advisor or the self-service types of accounts. Yes. And we often sit here and wonder, you know, is this the future of our industry? Do we need to start moving more in this self-service type of direction? And then we have an economy and a market that's doing things that no one ever would have imagined it would have done a few years ago, which creates a lot of, you know, confusion and difficult conversations with our clients where people start to say, gosh, you know, what am I paying you for? I mean, you've been kind of projecting this is going to happen, something different's happened, what's going on now? So the question I want to ask you, and I guess I have kind of a sense of how you'd probably answer it, because I'd probably answer it the same way, but I'd like to hear it spontaneously from you, is what do you really see as the key value of hiring a financial advisor at the end of the day? If someone is wondering, you know, can I do this on my own? Am I going to wind up paying someone 1% or, you know, a flat fee or something to do this? What could they do that I couldn't do on my own? How would you answer that question?
Well, first, I think it's probably more important to talk about the automated component, you know, to kind of compare what we do to something else. And I will say outright, and I don't mind saying that, one, from an investment standpoint, I think that right now it appears that robo-advisors, you know, specifically, and when we say robo-advisors, I'm speaking specifically about the investment platforms that are taking
Give me a little kind of a quick synopsis of what that would look like or feel like.
Well, there are a lot of different varieties of this. Most are based on, you know, how a human would determine how to allocate assets, and that is based on a risk tolerance and return objective, investment horizon, experiences, things like that. And so the software would take those inputs, or the human that then feeds it into the program would take those inputs, and a portfolio is created a lot of times utilizing ideas from modern portfolio theory.
Which is what?
Basically, just the optimization of a portfolio. Given a set of assets to choose from, it creates the optimal portfolio given a risk and return profile. So it is the portfolio that would generate the least amount of risk for a stated rate of return, or vice versa.
Looking backwards, of course, because that's all we have to work with.
Right. And it changes continuously. And that is the shortcoming of modern portfolio theory and the efficient frontier, and also robo-advising, is that that changes continuously. Right now, it's not an issue because of the popularity of passive investing right now. I think when we look back, we will see this as the golden age of robo-advising.
Yeah. You could pick the very worst investment for your situation and still make money in this environment.
Well, not only that, because everyone is doing it, right? So everyone has gotten on the bandwagon, and it's kind of gotten a little bit misguided. So, and it's been known for a long time that it's very hard to outperform, I'm using air quotes, the index, you know, the buy and hold strategy of buy this basket of securities and hold on to it forever versus active management where you're buying and selling all of the time. But just recently, this has come to the forefront because everybody's gotten so concerned about fees. So we're in a different environment. You know, we're in a low interest rate environment. Returns over the last, you know, let's call it 17 years, you know, since 2000, essentially, have not been what they have been historically. We had a big bull run, you know, from the 80s basically until the year 2000. And so people have gotten very focused on fees, and index investing has been a very easy way to address that issue. So this is very low cost investment options that in reality can oftentimes far outperform, you know, what you could either do on your own or pay someone a lot of fees to accomplish.
Right.
And so this has been coupled with and fits quite well with modern portfolio theory because we have a basket of securities. We know how they perform over a long period of time and over a short period of time. And so we can always look backwards and see the standard deviation or variance of that portfolio and how it reacts to different factors. So some modern portfolio theory would actually be the least complicated version of it, because it's basically just looking at variance, right? It's the mean variance optimization, and that's essentially just the return in variance is what we're looking at, and correlation, of course. And we want to see how those assets perform over time, and then we put it on the efficient frontier and so on and so forth. There are other more complicated versions of this that actually incorporate different factors, like economic factors, that mm-hmm. might change how one asset would react to a change in the given factor and how other assets would react to that. And so there are varying degrees of complication here. What I'm saying, and to get back around to my point, is right now, because everybody's utilizing the same tactic, which is passive investing, you know, there is no price discovery. So because everybody has just kind of thrown in the towel, we've been burnt twice in the last, you know, less than 20 years, mm-hmm. Trying to go out and pick individual securities, big time in the dot-com boom and bust. Less so during the last financial crisis, but people still felt that they were burned in the market, and they attributed that, I think, on a second order to active management to some degree. And so people have thrown in the towel and just said, look, you know, this is what I feel comfortable with. I'm not going to pay some Yahoo X, Y, and Z dollars to do it if I can just buy this one fund. And come to find out, you know, looking back 10 years, not a bad deal.
Right.
You know, you buy this one fund, you pay 0.03% annually mm-hmm. versus, you know, the 2% that would have been charged to, you know, starting in 2007, if you would have done that with a financial advisor back then, people were charging 2% all day long.
Right.
So we now have no negative influence, right? There's been no correction. Nobody has been hurt from utilizing this strategy. And so it has really been a perfect coupling with just being able to turn over your assets and allowing a computer to do it. And I'll be quite honest with you that there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, if a human is just going to do that anyway, and in large part, most financial advisors would just be trying to come up with a portfolio that reflects modern portfolio theory, mm-hmm. which is impossible for a human to do. I mean, it requires software because the efficient frontier is constantly moving,
right?
Because if we're always looking backwards, those things don't stay static. It's just always moving. So a human can't do it anyway.
Yeah.
So we might as well just allow the computer to do it if that is the end goal. The mm-hmm. end goal is to have a either utility optimized or just the global optimized portfolio. Let the computer do it, because it's going to be better than any human can do it. And we just don't have the mental capacity to do that. That begs the question, should I be doing that?
You as an advisor or as a client?
Everybody.
Uh-huh.
Right? Is modern portfolio theory the way to go, or even factor-based investing, or you know, whatever other models are being utilized to try to achieve this return objective given a certain amount of risk that is acceptable?
So I'm guessing your answer is no, this would not be the optimal way to invest.
Maybe. So it depends. And one of the big risks is that the math that is behind any of this thoughtful investing and the way that portfolios should be created is dangerous. So one, modern portfolio theory in and of itself is based on some ideas that just don't hold water all the time and can create a fair amount of risk. One of that is you know, the ever-shifting efficient frontier. So one, I allocate my dollars to what is the optimal portfolio today, and seconds later, it's no longer the optimal portfolio.
So unless you're in there tweaking it, adjusting it daily.
Constantly.
It doesn't remain efficient.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have issues with the underlying assumptions of beta, which are just beyond me, that we still refer to it as a metric of risk. So essentially the typical way to measure beta is the monthly correlation of a security with its benchmark,
mm-hmm.
and that is very dangerous. The idea that beta tells us anything. So just to prove a point, I was asked a question by somebody a couple of months ago, and I said, are you familiar with Tesla? And I said, yeah. And I said, that's a pretty high-flying stock. You know, it's been crushing it and is a neat company to watch. And I said, what do you think the beta of that is? I mean, you understand beta. And yes, I understand beta. 1.5, 2. You know, so if the S&P 500 went up, you know, 1%, it would go up, you know, 1.5 to twice that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, as of presently, the beta of Tesla is 1.02. So at that time, the assumption would be that if the S&P 500 moves up 1%, Tesla would go up 1.02%.
Right, almost in lockstep.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or if it goes down 1%, you know, it would just be a fraction off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be very, very small. That's obviously just not reality.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look backwards, of course, you know, beta is what beta is.
Yeah.
It is that. But it also doesn't necessarily capture that version of beta, which is the widely utilized version of beta, doesn't capture a lot of intra-month movements that someone buying a security based on beta would not be comfortable with. The idea that it's going to move like the market, well, there's a lot of time in between day one of the month and day one of next month. Right now, as of today, well, I don't know, as of a couple of days ago, I was using the same example, and I was surprised to find that the beta of Tesla was actually 0.76. So,
25%
difference. On a risk-adjusted basis, if we were following these guidelines, it would actually be a little bit more conservative. You would have to have a little bit lower risk tolerance than the S&P 500 in general to, you know, maybe add Tesla to your portfolio if you're utilizing beta in that way. And a lot of people do. That's one of the first things they learn.
And a lot of the softwares will use that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And this is my issue with a lot of the software is that really, I only came to this conclusion because I was a very early adopter of some of these stress testing softwares that were available for, you know, the less than, I mean, the proprietary software, the factor base and stuff, you know, for Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and some of these, you know, big houses that they've held it as their most closely guarded secret for decades, you know, so it's been around for a long time, value at risk, but it's, you know, computers are powerful enough now that we don't need 80 servers, you know, to get this done. Mm-hmm. You know, we can pack it into our laptop or keep it on the cloud. And so I was an early adopter of some of the software. And in using some of the most powerful versions of this that I could get my hands on, I realized this is bunk. Mm-hmm. This is crazy. And that's what opened my eyes. And I realized literally every portfolio that I optimized utilizing the software, I have to go back in and hand pick out an untold number of securities. Because yes, based on the past, this is what makes sense. The computer, we're only so far in the development of this software and understanding, so the computer can only see the past. And if it's looking at things like variance and return and its correlation with other asset classes and its exposure to different economic factors, that's it. It's concrete. And just by nature, because of what it's doing, it has to weigh more heavily the most recent past. Because if it's, you know, looking at all of the history of the security and it's weighing, you know, things from 1920 as heavily as things from 2015, well, the paradigm has probably shifted somewhere in there, and so it's no longer relevant. These software packages are essentially just a momentum driver, which I think is kind of a and I don't know this for sure, but I think that it's translating into what we're seeing today. I think that there are a lot more investors, whether institutional or retail, that are putting their dollars into accounts like this, and that is what is propagating what we're seeing in the market today, which is pretty much just a momentum-driven market. The problem is that it does not reflect, you know, forward-moving reality. Things that would be very easy to pick out for a human advisor with a fair amount of knowledge, the computer can't recognize. A couple of years ago, MLPs were a big one. I was having to pull MLPs out of every single portfolio that was being created because it was quite obvious to me that it was not as safe. I'm in conservative portfolios. I was trying to create conservative portfolios, and it kept stuffing MLPs in there because it was high income, right? It was producing a lot of income.
Relatively low volatility at the time.
At the time, it was only going up, you know, so it never went down. So the computer thought, this is the safest thing that you could possibly buy, and it's spinning off 6 and 7%. And a lot of people did have it in their portfolios. But every time I was thinking, okay, well, I also know what MLPs have done in the past, and I also know the intrinsic characteristics of MLPs. And sure shooting, you know, 6 months later, oil absolutely collapsed and MLPs went down with it.
So it sounds like we're getting close to what you would propose is the difference between using a human advisor, one, to the extent that they're doing something different than what the computer would just be doing anyway. And as you're talking about the MLPs, which by the way stands for Master Limited Partnerships, if you want to go check out what those are.
And these are oil MLPs, the oil and gas MLPs.
I can recall, and maybe you can too, Nate, well, this would have just been when you were kind of starting in the business. Around 2004, 2005, REITs, Real Estate Investment Trusts, were all the rage. And there were several people that I knew in this business that completely stopped their regular order of business, and all they were doing was selling these REITs or shares of REITs, which are not exchange traded. You go and you buy and kind of into a pool. It's almost like a non-traded mutual fund for just real estate. And they had interest that was at the time, you know, 9% a year. I mean, just crazy. People would be crazy not to do it. Real estate was booming. Right. Everybody thought it would never end. And these things blew up so bad that some of these guys, advisors I knew, I mean, got sued, went out of business. I mean, clients literally lost everything. I mean, it was a bad, bad situation. So where does the human element come into play, which I'm guessing was where the value would lie in actually hiring a human advisor? What should an advisor be doing to try to safeguard their practice and their advisors from the mistakes that these computers will just make because they're doing what computers do?
Well, one, I still believe that this technology that I've been describing provides a tremendous resource, some of it. And I still utilize a couple of pieces that I value highly with the knowledge that I have to go through and also use the other information that I possess to kind of override the software at certain points. So I think that the technology is going to be there moving forward. And I think that it can be used appropriately and would be a tremendous boon. The problem is that you've taken technology which should be given to analysts, right? People who, you know, look at numbers all day long and can understand what the computer is doing, and you've given it directly to a financial advisor who, you know, 10 years ago was just running their finger down a chart and saying, well, this mutual fund sounds good. Mm-hmm. And so that, in my opinion, has become very dangerous because I believe that some people are, I actually wrote kind of a thinly veiled article about it on our website that just said there are a lot of folks, unfortunately, who are using these software packages as if they're prescient, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is the first time they've ever seen them.
Yeah.
And so they're thinking,
this thing
is telling the future. Mm-hmm. It's telling me that I'm either going to make 25% or lose 15%, and that's it. Those mm-hmm. are the parameters of my
that's
portfolio.
That's the only thing that can happen.
That's right. Because mm-hmm. it's 95% certain that mm-hmm. that's what's going to happen. And that's a lot of these retail packages are saying, you know, with 95% probability that it's going to be between this and that. And people do not understand what that means either.
Because there's a roughly 100% probability that the market will look nothing tomorrow like it's looked for the last 100
not
years.
Only that, right? So right. The way that it looks, I mean, looking backwards, that could be true that there's a 95% probability mm-hmm. utilizing past data.
If history perfectly repeats itself.
And even if it did, that is not the danger mm-hmm. because people don't get crushed in the 95%. Mm-hmm. People get crushed in what we call the tail risk, mm-hmm. which is the 2.5% chance, which is not that rare, mm-hmm. right? 2.5% of the time, and I say 2.5% of the time, I know I was saying 95% because who cares about the other side?
Right.
So the other 2.5% is that you make much more money than the system says. Uh-huh. What I'm talking about is the 2.5% that says that not only do you lose a little bit more than what it's projecting, mm-hmm. but you could lose 100 times more than what it's projecting.
Right.
Because those very low probability events are what crush portfolios. Mm-hmm. And so people have this false sense of security, and I've seen it where they're even taking additional risk than they would have otherwise because they feel comfortable in this range of well, yeah, I mean, I could accept a potentially 30% downside for the, you know, potential benefit of making 60% mm-hmm. in a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take that risk.
Right.
But unfortunately, that 2.5% that's not captured by the software, or is captured by the software but isn't disclosed to the client, because who would ever do it if that were disclosed, mm-hmm. is negative 99%. And so, you know, it's very troubling.
I often think about that situation like with homeowners insurance, because people always kind of think out of both sides of their brain, which is just another way of saying speaking out of both sides of their mouth. I mean, there's an extremely minimal risk that your house is going to burn to the ground, but very few people don't get homeowners insurance to cover that. Because if it does happen, it will ruin you financially.
It'll ruin you.
Yeah.
But people don't think about that with their finances here. Mm-hmm. And this is really the first iteration of this software that is available to your Tom, Dick, and Harry. Mm-hmm. And that is going to blow up in people's faces. And I would be willing to, like, you know, put my stamp on this and say that, unfortunately, I think as valuable as this software really is, maybe even especially for the retail advisor, you know, the little advisor who has a smaller book of business, has a smaller shop, and is just trying to do as good a job as possible, it is extremely valuable for them, but it will be crushed and forever jaded by what is coming. And for two reasons. One, it is being marketed as something that it's not. It didn't start out that way.
Right.
It was marketed as what it was, but then as it gained in popularity, a lot of these software packages started to get a little bit greedy and they want more dollars, and so they're starting to market them as things that they're not. And unfortunately, those folks who do get burned even by the robo-advisors, that will be one of the hallmarks, unfortunately, that is brought back up 5 years from now is, well, one of the causes of this was the algorithmic trading and the turning over their portfolios to these. And that's not really going to be the case. It's just a misapplication of the technology, which could be potentially beneficial.
I'm going to tack on one more prophecy to that.
Okay.
So I think we could find ourselves in a situation, and I'm with you. I think the next downturn, whenever it happens, and who knows? I mean, I've been saying for 3 years now, we've got something big coming. It could be another 3 years. But when it does, all the pieces are in place for it to be really, really bad.
Now it is, yeah.
And from, we talked about this the other day with our show about regulators and how it influences advisors and clients. Right now, most advisors are thinking, if a regulator comes in here and wants to see that I've done some sort of due diligence, I can say, look, I ran it through this program that's way smarter than 10 humans. So yeah, I've done my due diligence. But what I think is going to wind up happening, because I saw this happen in 2008, is suddenly everything is going to change. Some attorneys are going to get hold of some people that lost a lot of money, and they're going to say, if someone told you that they had figured out your portfolio to do this because they use this software, call Joe and Billy at 800, you know, whatever, and all of a sudden that excuse is not going to work anymore. But
right
now it passes with the regulators when they come in. They
and that's why I'm
something.
Saying it's going to set the technology back, which otherwise would have been very beneficial. It's going to be pushed back to the Stone Age.
So let me ask you one more question as we're kind of getting long on time here. The other element that I think that will always lack from computers, and this is my thing with AI, though maybe sometime artificial intelligence will get to this point, is the psychological component that a computer can't evaluate from conversations we have, inflections of voice, the kind of stories people have about their past. What can advisors bring to the table that a computer at this point can't? And how does that play into what the overall plan should be?
Financial planning is a process, and it is the same process every time. The only outliers are the information that is input into that process. And so people have comparatively more complex situations or some situations that are very uncommon. As more and more of those fed into a system, basically everything could be known that would need to be known, and there would need to be very little human interaction to answer those, you know, one in a million questions that the software just can't pick up. Right now, we're not there, and happily so, you know, because I still need a job, but it's coming. So the youngest clients that I come across, I really have very little problem directing them towards robo-advice, because essentially that is what I would be doing for them. For long-term investment horizons, I would be trying to build out these fairly static long-term portfolios. With the inputs that I know that they'd be giving to the system, there's not quite as many moving parts as there might be for someone who's older, approaching an investment horizon, needs to start drawing out money, things like that. Basically, it's just telling a young person, go and buy the S&P 500, you know, go and buy an index fund. And that's what I know that they'll essentially get at or some blend of index funds at a robo-advisor. So I don't have a problem with that. Right now, the value that is being added by financial advisors, in my opinion, in certain spaces, under certain scenarios, like pre-retirement, immediate pre-retirement, 10, 5 years prior to retirement, into retirement, things get more complicated. Distributing assets is not as easy for a software package to accomplish on its own right now. And I think eventually, you know, the software will have that down pat too. But the real value, in my opinion, for human advisors today are the distribution phase of life, or as we're approaching investment horizons and needing to override some of the, just, you know, put it in an index and see what happens. And on the planning side, you know, handling those situations that are less than typical.
Well, let me give you one more spot where I perceive some value, and maybe it's just wishful thinking, and you tell me if this is another reason why I need to keep my pressure washing business up on the side. And this is something that only happens maybe over a 30-year career, 4 or 5 times people realize this value if the advisor is doing the job properly. And that is these inflection points in the market where people feel like, and we discussed this the last show and maybe even the show before that, their risk tolerance starts to drift. They feel like they want to be more aggressive. And this happens almost universally. People get too conservative after downturns. And in a software package, I mean, if you're answering the question at how you feel in the moment and it's doing a risk tolerance questionnaire and calculating these numbers, will give you the output based on what you put into it. But that's kind of a moving target. And I have found that some people feel a lot of value, thankfully, because they're still clients. And me being able to say, look, this is how we really need to be thinking about this at this point in time. And right now, I don't feel like there's lots of articles and books written that might help people think this, but most people are coming to see us because they don't feel like reading articles or books, and they're willing to pay us for that kind of thing. But if you make these mistakes at the worst possible times, and this is when people make those types of mistakes, it could be one of those situations where it doesn't matter how good your planning is after the mistake happens and you lose half your money or more of it. Or if you wind up falling short in your long-term objectives for rate of return because you stayed too conservative after a point in time, I see that as an area where an advisor who knows what they're doing and is not afraid to have the difficult conversation, then they're always difficult because, as I mentioned in the last show, people don't want to hear you need to be more conservative when the valuations of the market are where they are now, and they don't want to hear you need to be more aggressive after everyone just bled out of their portfolios for 3 years. But I think that's something that clients, if they're taking to heart what the advisor says and they trust the advisor's perspective on this, is something where they could also find some value.
And that is overriding the software, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, that would be the unfortunate thing is that many advisors today are just adding their fee on top of the software. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, they're
so in addition to the software, they're providing no additional value except typing on the keyboard.
That's right. Yeah, they're inputting the data. Mm-hmm. They're the ones inputting the data and then collecting 1-2%, you know, whatever the going rate is. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. One of those value points, which sounds crazy because it's the exact reason why, you know, many of our clients hate us at this moment is because we're telling them, which it just is what it is. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if there are any justification for a financial advisor in the pay that is made, it's the amount of stress that we have to take home on a daily basis in trying to do what we believe is absolutely the right thing, which is not necessarily what everybody else thinks is the right thing at the time. Mm-hmm. And it creates a lot of friction, and it's very difficult to go on trying to do what you believe is the right thing in the face of so many other people apparently succeeding doing the wrong thing. And as Jesse Livermore from Reminiscences of a Stock Operator said, the new investor, you know, gets very rich and sees all his profit on paper, and on paper is where it stays. and that's what happens, uh-huh. right? So, I mean, we do well and it goes up and we get confident in what we're doing. I think the only difference is that a human advisor that has been doing it for a little while and hopefully has been doing it with their own money for a little while has a little bit of humility that they can save their clients from. So in other words, they paid tuition. They've either seen a couple of rounds and have learned a thing or two, or have utilized their own dollars to realize that it's not always what it seems on the back of the cereal box, and can spare their clients from that misery.
Just a kind of a quick synopsis, Nate, of what you think those key bullet points are of if you're in this situation, here's where you'll find value from an advisor.
As we start to approach investment horizons and where we need to start preparing for distributions are the big one that the software really just can't touch right now. Making those final preparations and making sure, and this is the big one, is risk management. Mm-hmm. Making sure that we don't make huge missteps in preparation for a shift in investment time horizons, you know, leading into retirement, starting those distributions and then kind of making those, you know, second and third step plans. Those are huge transitions. And if the mark is missed, you know, I've personally seen that go sideways deep. And that's where I think that the professional advisor still provides value today.
Now, you need to understand something, listener, about Nathan and I. We are the consummate do-it-yourselfers. If it can be learned without having to go get a college degree, and we've even thought about going getting special degrees. We like to do things ourselves. And we recognize a lot of people just go, look, for the price that I'm paying, there's value in me not even having to think about it.
Right.
Of course, if you're going to do that, you need to do, as a consumer of financial services, your due diligence and making sure you're getting what you're paying for, evaluating the quality and tenure and experience and things like that of the person that you're going to be working with. That's the advice I'd give in that regard. But there's certainly space in the marketplace because there will always be just people who say,
right,
I know this is important, but I just don't want to deal with it.
Right. Or I don't have the time, which is true.
The bottom line here is if you ever are in Jacksonville looking for a financial advisor and you come to see Nathan, you can come see me after Nathan drives you right out the door and I'll work with you.
And I mean, you know that this is true. You know that I'm not just saying it's, and Nick laughs at me, and I'm also get laughed at frequently by the other advisors in our office. I frequently tell people what they need to hear and say, you can do this yourself. You don't need me for this.
So I guess the key thing would be find out if you can do it yourself and make that determination. And if you can and you feel like you're competent to do it, then hey, go for it.
Yeah.
If not, here's our card.
That's right.
All right, that's it for this show. Hope you enjoyed this format. We'll see how it goes next week. Maybe we'll dabble in another format. Who knows? That's the joy of listening to all the episodes. You never know what you're going to get. I'm Nick Edwards.
I'm Nathan Edwards.
We'll see you next time.